It's very likely we don't know so much the rationale of Jonah. I think, obviously, we know the rationale that he understood what the implications were to going through to the Assyrians. And I think Jonah, perhaps, you know, we all know this, but sin makes you stupid, but it also makes you rather irrational, too. It appears to me that his attempt to go is very much filled with a lot of symbolic language. He goes down, 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 all the way to the depths of Sheol. Jonah is reliving what we see in Psalm 139, is he's trying to find refuge and escape, which is what everybody does. But I don't think this specifically means he was trying to find refuge under the ruler of another god or under another nation. But I think this is his irrationality leading him to embed a kind of theology that is absent from God. But it's very clear that even throughout, this is kind of he's running away, but throughout it's very clear that he is cogitating and meditating on godly principles. When the mariners ask him, who are you? Who is your God? We don't know how the chronology functioned, but it seems like the fastest conversation in history. Who are you? I'm a Hebrew. I worship the God of Israel, the God who created the heavens and the earth. So it seems that he is constantly living with this bombardment of what he knows to be true and fighting against that truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm reminded of, I can only paraphrase Paul in Thessalonians saying, we're not people of the darkness, we're people of the light. But like Psalm 139, when we want to sin, it is, if not physically, emotionally or whatever, we try to run as far as we can away from God. Because we just know it's just insane about what we're about to do, what we're about to say, how we're about to think.
Right. Yeah. This goes back to the conversation we had earlier about people who, when they're fleeing from God, especially when there are divorces or separation, they want a time away from church. Mm-hmm. And that is a Jonah-like response.
Yeah.
And it does not lead to a good place.
Joe, you have a strong voice. Get up, speak.
Oh, that's the man who was trying to match my voice last night.
Could you explain the significance between the seaweed wrapped around Jonah's head and the head covering around Christ in the grave? You were talking yesterday about the Christology behind the song and the Psalm of Jonah. What sort of importance is there in that head covering?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's a lot to say here, but the one thing to keep in mind is that death very, very typically, I apologize for the Baptist here for this illustration here, but the reason the whole body does not need to be submersed is because the head is where life is found, right? That's why the Spirit of God is poured over our heads, at least in baptism. But death is the same way too. So when you see imagery of creation surrounding you and choking you, that's creation, that's God's creation pushing against you, right? And if you don't allow God to do what he needs to do, if you fight against it, the tighter it gets. And so the language that we see in the tomb as well is death is trying to strangle Jesus. Death is trying, oh death, where is thy sting? Trying to sting Jesus. Where is thy victory? Where is thy, the grave is trying to keep Jesus in prison to that Sheol-like experience, and Jesus sort of rises triumphant, and he becomes our head. He becomes our great composer. He becomes the final new Adam whose head will be exalted among the nations. In the Proto-Evangelion in Genesis 3:15, it says, the seed of the woman shall crush the head of the serpent. So Jonah is in the serpent, living like a serpent. He's being tortured. His head is being strangled. His neck is being strangled. He can't breathe, it says in Jonah 2. He can't breathe. I find it interesting that it's only in that section when he says, but yet I shall look upon the house of the Lord or the place of worship that the situation begins to unfold and leads to his declaration of God's salvation. And then, as soon as he says, salvation is of Yahweh, the vomiting takes place. The expulsion takes place. But again, the language is that in death, you're strangled, and the imagery is always your head. Your neck is being strangled. But in life also, your head is being liberated so it cannot be crushed. It cannot be crushed. Incidentally, that's what the Assyrians did. One of their practices was to crush the heads of their opponents. Yeah. And to impale them. I mean, the imagery is pretty dark. Sorry, children.
Did that tie into where when... John the Baptist baptized Jesus in the light when in the form of the dove.
Repeat that again. When John the Baptist baptized Jesus, Matthew 3.
And the dove fell down.
Yes.
And the dove.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the dove descends. Is there
that's what I'm talking about.
There you go.
That's what I'm talking about. So now you begin to see all these little images. What's your name? Lily.
Lily. Oh,
beautiful name. Now you begin to see all these imageries here. Right? Remember, your name means something. I don't think there's anybody on planet Earth with my name. My name is Lily. My name is Uri Ezo. Uri means fire in Hebrew, and then Yesu means Jesus in Greek. My father was a very crazy linguist. I mean, you don't know what that means, but he was crazy. And he put that name together. Nobody has my name. But every time I walk around, I think, Jesus is my light. Jesus is my fire. Jesus is my... And Jonah has to, especially in the Old Testament, there was a lot of meaningfulness, right? Today, people choose their baby sisters' names based on something that was important to them. In the Old Testament, the names were given because it was a calling. It was something that they were called to do for the rest of your lives, for the rest of their lives. And Jonah's name was a dove. Doves hover over creation as a way of showing God's blessings and to bring life out of darkness. And in Matthew 3, the dove hovered over Jesus, and the Father says, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." So when a dove is above you, that means God is blessing you through the power of the Spirit. That's what's taking place. So in that case, the Spirit was affirming the mission of Jesus. And that's what Jonah should have done from the beginning. But he had to learn it the really, really hard way. The point is, don't take the hard road. Take the road of righteousness.
My daughter wants to know, how did Jonah stay alive?
How did Jonah stay alive? Yeah. I don't think he did. I don't think he did. I think he actually physically died. And in Sheol, God raised him from the dead. God raised him from the dead. And I think it's the exact parallel that Jesus uses in Matthew 12. Because I think the parallel is identical. It's not just... You know, it's not just generic, but it's identical.
Yeah, but help us here. How can Jonah be dead and write a psalm?
Everything that was written are post... Well, he's risen.
The psalm that he sings in chapter 2. Is he dead when he's singing this?
I think his repentance happens in Sheol.
Okay.
Yeah. And he's reflecting on that, and he is... And that composition is a Sheol composition that can only happen... when you're in the darkness and death.
Yeah. And so we think of death as almost non-existence, but that's not true.
Yeah, we can't think of that because when Jesus dies, he didn't cease to exist.
Exactly. Right? Nope.
Jesus, actually, I mean, the reality is, Jesus, we don't know the Eastern Orthodox tradition, they have this whole litany that what they believe Jesus to have said to the captives. So we don't know what he said, but what the Orthodox tradition kind of says that Jesus essentially composed his own psalm to proclaim to the captives and set the captives free. It would make sense, but we don't know that for a fact.
All the way in the back. Hang on. Get ready, Nate. Morris.
Hey, Pastor Brito.
Hello.
I have a question here, and I don't know if I'm following this correctly. So your thesis is that Jonah doesn't want to go to Nineveh because not because he just doesn't like them or somehow tribalist against them, but if he goes there, they will repent. God will then potentially help them turn on Israel. He's going to go preach to his enemies, and they may then turn and destroy his people.
Yes.
And he doesn't want that to happen, but that's what God's called him to do.
Because northern Israel has a trajectory of idolatry, yes.
Makes sense. What's the... what's the analogy for us? When are we asked to preach to a people that might turn around and destroy us? Yeah. Does that make sense?
I think Jonah's patriotic tendencies were noble, but your patriotism, your love for country, when it contradicts the demands of God, it becomes an idolatrous patriotism. And I do think we see a lot of that in our country as well, a kind of idolatrous patriotism. I think God has made all things new. In Revelation 20, it says that the devil cannot keep the nations from receiving the gospel no longer, as he did in the Old Covenant scriptures. Of course, we see glimpses of the gospel going to the nations. I think that kind of principle by nature has been abolished in the resurrection of Jesus and in the pouring of the Spirit in Acts chapter 2, so that all nations are clean, so that all nations are ripe for harvest. Therefore, the only principle that is applicational is the principle of wisdom, whether it's wise to...
Let's thank him again.
A lot of foolish missionary movement to places. And I say particularly with people who, in like broader pietistic, Billy Graham kind of evangelical churches who go to a foreign land because they went to a mission trip in, you know, 20 years ago, and they just want to go. My point is that the greatest missiological endeavor in U.S. in history happened in the 18th, 19th century, right? With a lot of British, a lot of missionaries. All these men were adequately prepared theologically to go into the mission field. And so my point is, you don't just send out for the sake of sending, but you equip and prepare before you send. But the principle is all nations are open for harvesting now, contrary to how it was in the Old Testament.
Thank you, Pastor Brito. You want to be, you're going to have to get through two more chapters tonight.
Pray for me.
That's right.